Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Hope you're all digging out okay from yesterday's storm. I know some of you lost power last night, some of you for a second time in a week. And the snow totals are so disparate. Have you heard this? Just 3 inches in Central Park, and no more than 6 that I've seen reported for Nassau County, but 11 out in Stony Point. And listen to these New Jersey totals, 8 inches in Ridgewood, 15 in West Orange, and not so far from West Orange, also in Essex County, in fact, 23 in North Caldwell. And north of the city, how about 26 inches in Monroe, Putnam Valley 26, New Fairfield 26. But in the New Haven area, we have West Haven 4 inches, but North Haven 13, and hello Berkshires, 30 inches in North Adams. So I hope you have good snowplows or good neighbors. All right, so there's a little snow news. We'll begin today by taking President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs seriously as a policy proposal. As you know, on this show, when the president uses racism or other forms of hate to promote himself politically, we don't treat it as an issue with two sides. When he blatantly lies or shows corrupt moral character, we just call it out. And yes, that's almost every day. And when he reveals that he doesn't even understand the policies that he spouts and is just spouting them for reality TV purposes, we label it as such. And that last one might apply to tariffs too, especially when the president announces them in what seems like an impulsive outburst, taking his own White House officials largely by surprise. But when there is an actual substantive policy proposal that might actually become law or U.S. government policy and affect a lot of people, we'll still dive in with multiple points of view. So the 10% tariff on aluminum imports, 25% on steel is being denounced by most economists, and you know about it apparently being the last straw for Trump's chief economics advisor, Gary Cohn, who's announced his resignation. But there may be more Democrats than Republicans who find some merit in targeted tariffs, and the AFL-CIO has endorsed the idea. So to begin the program today, we will get two views, beginning first with a rising star in the Democratic Party, Congressman Tim Ryan, who represents the Akron and Youngstown area of Ohio, obviously hard hit by the decline of the American steel industry. Ryan, as you may know, also challenged Nancy Pelosi after the last elections for the position of House Minority Leader. He has said in general, after Trump carried his state, that the Democratic Party alienates a lot of voters it doesn't have to alienate while still sticking to its values, could still stick to its values without alienating so many people, but that its current state will make it harder than it has to be to win back control of the House this year. His name has even been mentioned as a possible 2020 Democratic presidential primary candidate, and we'll get to that a little bit too. Congressman Ryan, we so appreciate you coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much. You know, being an Ohio guy, it's fun to hear someone else talk about all the snow that you got. So
yeah, right.
I hope everybody's okay.
That's right. Well, you know, growing up in New York and living in Albany for 8 years, and then I went to grad school at Ohio State. And
oh my goodness.
I never had so much snow anywhere I was in the year that I was in Columbus. So I know how you get.
It's all part of our charm.
Can you give our listeners here in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut first a sense of your district in Ohio and what has happened to steel or aluminum jobs over the years? Is that a good place to start?
Sure. Yeah, my district is in Northeast Ohio. I represent the cities of Akron and the city of Youngstown and points in between. I'm halfway between Cleveland and Pittsburgh, so heart of the old steel belt, and you know the peak of the Industrial Revolution that's obviously been hard hit in the last 30 to 40 years through globalization and now more automation than anything, where we've seen an erosion of these manufacturing jobs happen for a long time. And a bunch of cities that are on the comeback, we have little pockets of innovations with additive manufacturing. In Akron, we're doing polymers. At Kent State University, we're doing liquid crystal and trying to spin off companies there. So we're on the comeback, but still a legacy of of manufacturing, including steel and aluminum. And we've seen a lot of those integrated steel mills go by the wayside, losing thousands, tens of thousands of jobs. We've seen in the U.S. aluminum companies, I think we had 12 or 13 at one point. Now we're down to just two or three major aluminum companies in the United States. So we've been kind of at the tip of the spear of that decline in the industrial age that we had here in the United States.
So you represent your district, obviously. Can you make the case, though, that targeted tariffs are not just good for your district, but for America as a whole?
Well, there's a lot of factors here, and I know, because I'm, sometimes one of them. I think Trump, President Trump, does not always think through what he does, and I think he knows that this issue is a issue that hits home in areas like mine, and he knows he needs to do well in Western PA, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. But I will say, with regard to targeted tariffs, two countries that are blatantly cheating. So, just to give everybody a sense. China pushing, say, steel tubing for the energy industry, their final product that lands on the shores of the United States is the same cost as an American company's raw material costs. That's the advantage that they have for a variety of different ways that they do it. They dump, enormous amounts of steel on the country. They subsidize the business locally. They, for long periods of time, would manipulate their currency to make it artificially cheap so that their exports were cheaper coming in. They've done all of these different things, and it's part of a broader strategy. So I think people need to think of, especially China, in the context of what are they doing? What's their long-term strategy? It gets hard for us in the United States because we really don't have a long-term strategy. This move on tariffs is really a tactic. Where it's no long-term strategy, but China does have a long-term strategy. They are rebuilding their own country, moving towards renewable energy, wind, solar. They're moving to high-speed rail, battery-powered cars. They're building islands in the South China Sea, and they're putting military bases on them, projecting force. They're opening bases in Africa, and they're exploiting Africa for its natural resources to continue to feed its industrial machine. They use mercantilist tactics to increase their ability to hurt and damage other countries' economics, like they're trying to do with us, in the steel industry, and erode our manufacturing base. So people need to see it, especially from China, in this broader context of what they're trying to do. And then, in addition to that, this kind of dumping. There are remedies through the General Agreements on Trade and Tariff going back to 1948. It's Article 21 that allows a country to provide a remedy to a violation of international law. And the Trade Export Act in the United States from 1962 gives us the ability, if someone's trying to intentionally hurt us and hurt our defense industrial capacity, meaning we have to be able to at least supply our own military. So, yeah, we want fair trade. Yes, we realize we're in a global economy. Yes, we have to be engaged with the world. I'm not saying build a wall and be protectionist, but what I am saying is if another country is intentionally trying to damage us and damage certain industries, there has to be remedies for us to punish them. And that's what I believe is a targeted move here that is appropriate.
Let me follow up on a couple of things you said. One, you mentioned Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, which is going to sound like a nerdy and wonky thing to bring up to a lot of people, but this is breaking out as a controversy. The United States has an imposed trade restrictions basically on national security grounds since 1983, something about machine tools at that time during the Reagan administration. Are you arguing that there is a legitimate national security interest in these tariffs?
I believe there is, and I believe that industry and the steel industry and the aluminum industry, they have to be commercially viable. So it's not just, they hang around, like factories can hang around until we go to war, and then, we're going to build a new factory and supply new airplanes, new C-130s, new F-16s, new F-18s. We have to have that industrial capabilities. And if there is some damage or harm to the broader global market, my argument is, we have to do it because we have to maintain that capability. And I think the market will adjust. I don't think it's going to be as damaging as everybody says. I don't want a trade war. I don't think trade wars are good. I disagree with the president on that. I don't think Canada and Germany and some of these other countries should at all be involved in this. I think it needs to be targeted to countries like China who are directly and intentionally trying to manipulate the situation.
And even if we accept everything you said about China, which I think all those things you listed are generally accepted about China. So if we just hit China, even just that one country, for its steel dumping practices, why doesn't that start a trade war or risk starting a trade war with that country that sells Americans so many affordable goods these days, no matter what we think of their labor practices, to allow them to do that? Do they not have more leverage than we do to hurt us more than we hurt them in what might be a limited trade war against China?
Well, again, the president, in his inflammatory rhetoric, is moving away from the substantive policy issues, which I'm pretty confident he doesn't fully understand. That if we assess these tariffs, countervailing duties, anti-dumping provisions, based on a legitimate national security issue that the Department of Commerce has realized and analyzed and told us that it is the case, then that is an appropriate legal remedy for us to assess these countervailing duties and anti-dumping provisions. Now, if China would then retaliate, that would actually be the beginning of the trade war. If they said, well, we're going to put, you know, we're going to increase the cost or prevent whatever you're shipping here, we're going to increase the tariffs on those products.
So how confident
for
are
no national security grounds, then that would be the beginning of the trade war.
So that's where blame would lie. But why are you confident that imposing the steel and aluminum tariffs wouldn't cause them to do that? Because they don't really care if they're blamed.
Well, again, so my position is that the national security implications in the short, mid, and long term for the United States are the biggest priority here for us. And we need to make sure that we maintain those capabilities. I mean, we cannot rely on Vladimir Putin for Russian steel. I mean, that's not the position we want to be in. We have to maintain a defense industrial base. And that is, to me, the highest order for all of us. Now, let me be very, very clear here. I don't think that this assessment, this countervailing duty position and what the president's doing here is going to have a huge effect on job growth. It's not going to bring the steel industry back. You know, I'm not a Luddite. I don't think that, you know, we're going to build walls and think that, you know, we can retreat back to the United States. We have got a million other things that we need to do to grow the economy, to get investment into the industrial Midwest, to, you know, lay broadband, move to renewable energy, all of the things. I did a bus tour 2 weeks ago, and I brought 12 Silicon Valley venture capitalists to Youngstown, Akron, Flint, Detroit, and South Bend, Indiana, because we need private investment pushing technologies, the latest and greatest, into these areas that have fallen behind and have not participated in globalization. So I don't want to give anybody the sense that I think, boy, if we put these tariffs on, Youngstown Sheet and Tube's going to come back and hire 20,000 people. That's just not going to be the case.
Right.
But I do think it's an appropriate remedy given the fact that China's intentionally doing this.
And have you run any of the numbers on jobs overall? Because one of the most common critiques I've heard is that if we raise the price of imported steel, we'll get more steel made here, but not that many more jobs because of modern robotics in the steel industry. And the tariffs will actually cost us jobs in industries that use steel to make things, like the auto industry. Our guest later in the hour, economics professor Joseph Francois from Bern, Switzerland, argues it would create about 33,000 U.S. jobs, but cost 180,000. Do you have different numbers?
No, I mean, I think that there will be a reaction in the market. Now, I do think there's still global competition, so it's not like, you know, prices are going to go through the roof all of a sudden. There are still, you know, we still get steel from Russia, from Brazil, you know, we get it from South Korea, we get it from Japan. So there's still a global market for steel, so I don't think that it's going to have that huge of an impact. But what I'm arguing here is that losing that last bastion of our defense industrial base is not worth it. And so you may see some job growth and you may see some shifts in job production in other areas. That very well may happen. But at the end of the day, I think we have to protect the integrity of our defense industrial base. So I'm not blind to that this is going to have damage. I'm just saying that in the long term, and look, we had a $1 billion steel mill expansion in Youngstown that really only produced about 400 or 500 additional jobs. So this industry, like coal and others, is being extremely automated, which is why I'm saying we've got to get Silicon Valley into the Midwest. We've got to get investment into the Midwest. We've got to lay broadband in the Midwest. We've got to do a new energy grid. We've got to push new renewable energy sectors of the economy that are growing by 20-25% a year into coal country, into steel country. So this isn't a holistic economic growth plan. This is about protecting our defense industrial base. And quite frankly, it doesn't go far enough because we're also losing in different areas in the metals capability, which we need for a lot of the sophisticated machinery that we use in our defense industrial base as well.
We have a few minutes left with Congressman Tim Ryan, Democrat from Ohio. Can I ask briefly, and I think you have to go and vote in a couple of minutes, but can I ask what you're thinking these days in terms of how the Democratic Party looks nationally a year and a little into Trump and your challenge to Nancy Pelosi for minority leader?
Well, I think we're going to see here in a few days. We have a special election in Western PA for an open congressional seat. Connor Lamb is running in that seat. And the polls have him pretty much neck and neck, maybe a little up a point or two. That election is on Tuesday, so we'll have a little canary in the coal mine, so to speak, with the Connor Lamb. I think he's doing a very good job of kind of talking about bringing in some new leadership. I think he's doing a very good job focusing on economics, those kind of things that unite us. He's talking about pensions and Social Security and Medicare and health care and jobs and wages, which really is an issue I think we've kind of lost on in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think if he wins, that will really be the model moving into the fall for other Democrats, focusing on the economic issues, those things that unite us and those things that people are talking about in places like Youngstown, Ohio. They're still struggling to make ends meet. They're still living paycheck to paycheck. And we have got to speak to their aspiration. I'll just give you one quick example. We talk a lot about raising the minimum wage, you know, which I'm for and a lot of people are for, $12, $13, $15, fight for 15.
Right.
Here's the issue. People in places like Youngstown, upstate New York, and other places, at one point they were making $40 an hour. Now they're making $15. So if our sole focus is on $15 an hour, we are not speaking to the aspiration of that family, of that worker. And so sometimes we get caught up so focused on an issue like that that we're missing the aspiration. And I want to see Democrats say, we need to be talking about $30 or $40 an hour. Yeah, it's not going to be the old steel job from 40 years ago, but it may be computer coding. It may be laying broadband. It may be working to lay a new energy grid, a smart grid, or moving into the renewable energy sector. But we've got to speak to that aspiration. And if we don't, you know, guys like Trump come in and people default their vote back to nostalgia, back to coal mines and steel mills, which isn't even within the realm of reality, as we just talked about.
So last question for now, and I hope we can continue this on another occasion. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking to, you know, the New York area and lower New England as a Ohio congressman. Not everybody thinks the Democrats can win back many white working class, mostly male voters, without downplaying the issues of women and immigrants and African Americans to the point where the party would not be sticking to its principles or risk creating voter apathy in too much of its current base. You think the party can walk that line more successfully than it is, I know. Can you lay out for our listeners in, you know, our diverse area of the country here how you think it can do that?
The systems are broken all over the country, and we need a political party that can help us rebuild new systems. And so whether you're talking about an economic system, as we just did, that is not producing the kind of high-wage jobs and security that we need, or you're talking about a criminal justice system that's broken, that's putting African-American kids, you know, really in a tough situation with, you know, getting busted at a young age for marijuana and that ruining your whole life and your ability to go get a job. That's a broken criminal justice system that in many ways is racist. The immigration system, clearly we see every single day how broken it is, whether you're talking about comprehensive immigration reform or the Dreamers, the inability for this system to be able to bring people in safely to our country and assimilate them in our country. That's a broken system. We have a broken food system where you have half the country now has diabetes or pre-diabetes, and we subsidize crops that lead to very highly processed food that has created a really a sick country that we have right now. That system is broken. Our agricultural system is broken. We have algae blooms in the Great Lakes and dead zones at the mouth of the Mississippi River. We have climate change is a huge issue. So all of these systems are broken. And the Democratic Party, my estimation, has got to be the party that is going to bring these systems and the government into the 21st century and start making the government work for the people. And whether you're a black kid in New York City or you're a Latino out in Los Angeles or you're, you know, a white working class person in the Midwest, our party needs to be for everybody. A woman who lives in a state that where there's being attacks on women's rights, or if you're a teacher in West Virginia. I mean, we have got to stop saying we can only be for one segment at a time. This party is a party of America. This is the party of the great society. We can walk and chew gum at the same time, and we have to. That's how we're going to reclaim our country, not this division that we get from the President of the United States, where he intentionally tries to divide us. We've got to say we are joining hands, locking arms, and we're going at this together. And we're going to fix the economic system. We're going to fix the criminal justice system. We're going to fix these attacks on women's rights. We're going to fix the immigration. But we have to do it together. This is my main point. We can't achieve any of those goals if we are divided. If we let the president and the Republicans and the Koch brothers divide us, nobody's going to get anything. We're not going to get criminal justice reform. We thought maybe that was going to be the big issue that the Republicans and Democrats are going to work on together. That ain't happening. Immigration reform. We can't even get 900,000 Dreamers to feel safe in the country. We have got to come together, white, black, brown, male, female, gay, straight, together, arm in arm, and say, this is the Democratic Party of 2018, 19, 20, and we're going to fix all of this stuff because we're going to have a massive coalition, including a generation of young kids who want to get assault weapons off of the streets. We're going to solve these problems, but we got to do it together and recognize that we can't achieve this stuff alone. That, to me, is the future of the Democratic Party.
Congressman Tim Ryan, Democrat from Ohio, thank you so much for giving us some time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Interesting conversation with Congressman Ryan there, whose name, if you haven't heard it before, you're likely to hear in the future. He did challenge Nancy Pelosi for the position of House Minority Leader, Democratic Leader, last year. If the Democrats win the House, we'll see if he challenges her for Speaker next year or even tries to run for president in 2020, as people are speculating he might, as a representative of that approach that he was just articulating to growing and regrowing the Democratic Party in the U.S. We'll continue that conversation with other guests as we go. But right now, another view on the president's steel and aluminum tariffs in particular from Joseph Francois, managing director and professor of economics at the World Trade Institute in Bern, Switzerland. He also contributed to a new report on tariffs that we will talk about here. Professor Francois, thank you very much for coming on. Hello from New York.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
I don't know how much of Congressman Ryan you were able to hear on tariffs there, but if so, where would you like to start to respond?
Okay, so I heard the whole thing. And I actually find that I agree with where Congressman Ryan is in terms of what he's worried about and what his objectives are. I'm just not convinced that the current proposed remedies actually get us there. But I think he's right in terms of worrying about economically distressed communities. I think we need to think about how we move the old economy into the old manufacturing heartland. The thing is, wage stagnation goes back to the 70s. We've been going through an industrial revolution, basically, restructuring, getting rid of more labor-intensive production. And we haven't really dealt with the consequences of it. And this is something that's been happening for decades. I think he's entirely right about that. I don't see that putting duties on China for steel doesn't really – I don't see that that gets us there. Partly just – it's boring, but the numbers, right? So about 90% of Chinese steel exports to the U.S. are already covered by dumping duties or countervailing duties, which is a – for the non-technical people in the audience, these are tariffs because the government has found that trade is dumped or is subsidized. China is a very small share directly of U.S. steel imports. So again, if you do want to keep China, you want to help the steel industry, unless you are going after our friends, Mexico and Canada and Germany and so on, you don't get much directly with these duties. And it is there is the question of what happens to downstream industries that consume steel, construction, washing machines, things of that sort.
And Congressman Ryan didn't even seem to question your premise, because I read him your numbers from your report, 180,000 lost jobs for about 33,000 created if we go ahead with widespread steel and aluminum tariffs. And he didn't even really question it. He seemed to say that it's more important for, the premise that a country like China can't just get away with dumping below cost to warp the global market without some kind of retaliation. And B, it's so important for our potential for making war, if we need it for national security purposes, that we have to be a country that makes steel to be able to make our own weapons, so it's not in the hands of Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin or even Canada or Germany, that we have enough steel to do that. Did you hear it that way? He wasn't actually arguing with your jobs numbers.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think it's good to go back and look at the last time we were here, which was in the Bush administration. Okay, so early 2000s, we went through roughly the same thing. Again, duties were put in place. They stayed in for a few years, and then they were brought down. Since then, so U.S. steel production is actually up about 8% since the start of 2000. But it's the jobs that are gone, right? So the way that we make steel has changed dramatically, right? So we've lost about 40% of steel jobs while making the same amount of steel. So it's not really that imports have sort of forced the amount of production down. It's just that we don't have the kind of steel jobs we used to have. And I agree with the congressman when he said that, this won't bring the old type steel jobs back. It may be good for jobs for robots, and it may shift certain types of production more into the U.S., but it will hurt downstream. And it doesn't address the broader problem, which is across manufacturing overall, output is up while jobs fall. Okay, and so it's a problem not just for steel. It's a problem for the old manufacturing heartland in terms of the change in how we make things. And this doesn't address that. It's sort of it's a distraction in a way.
And do you think – I heard today with the president planning now maybe to exempt Canada and Mexico for, I think he says, national security reasons, also maybe because we have obligations under the NAFTA treaty. I'm not sure. But I heard an alternative theory of why it doesn't matter if we exempt Canada or Mexico, because or why that would be damaging to the president's project here, because if we exempt Canada, a lot of Chinese and other foreign steel will basically get laundered through Canada. They'll ship it to Canada, and then they'll sell it, whoever the intervening party is, will sell it as Canadian steel to the United States. And so if we exempt Canada, we neuter the project that the president is trying to go after. How much do you agree with that?
No, I mean, there's something called rules of origin. So when you have a free trade agreement, there are provisions to determine where something was made. And so it's what you're describing, if they did it successfully, is a criminal enterprise. But it's customs fraud. You have to indicate where something came from. I think the bigger worry is that China depresses steel globally. It doesn't ship much directly to the U.S., but Korea, for example, buys Chinese steel. That means they can sell washing machines cheaper in the U.S. The trading system doesn't deal well with the fact that value chains are now global, right, that you're sourcing stuff from various places. And so U.S. producers using U.S. steel are at a disadvantage with Koreans because the Chinese buy Korean steel, for example.
Yeah.
But you know, we recently did a trade remedy on washing machines, too. So it's the Chinese steel is covered by dumping. It's covered by countervailing duties. The products where they do end up pushing down the cost of downstream steel products, I think we need to address that. And there is there was anyway an effort to address the overcapacity through the OECD and through the G20. And I'm not sure if this is going to help that process move forward. But the goal was to share data, to work on getting capacity down. The Chinese were sort of grudgingly cooperating on that. And this kind of pulls the rug out from that process.
Do you think there would be a trade war? Do you think China would start raising the prices of all kinds of other things? I raised that scenario with Congressman Ryan, and he said, well, yeah, then we wouldn't be starting the trade war. They would be starting the trade war. This is just setting fair rules when they're unfairly dumping steel. But I'm not sure if it matters who we say started the trade war as opposed to who did something legitimate. If China decides to retaliate against steel tariffs by raising the price, you know, of all kinds of things that the U.S. would want to import there, and we're trying to have an export economy, you know, not to mention how they might raise the price on all kinds of American goods that American consumers buy at reasonable prices because they come from China, no matter what we think of their labor policies, that there's going to be a bigger reaction, therefore a bigger harm than action.
You know, there may be. Though notice here that all this is about, you know, China vis-a-vis the U.S., the EU vis-a-vis the U.S. It's not China vis-a-vis Europe, for example. And so it would be sort of the U.S. position and the rest of the global economy that would be affected by this. There are provisions within the GATT or within the WTO where if you take safeguards, which is basically what President Bush had done, and you argue that you need to protect an industry for a while, you can do that. But you have to give back concessions for other products. And when you negotiate a trade agreement, you know, I let you sell me steel, you sell me whiskey, and so if you take away the steel concessions, I'll take away the whiskey concessions.
Yeah.
Right. And so what, you know, assuming that.
So you're saying President Trump always talks about he doesn't like these big multi-country free trade agreements because the U.S., he says, always winds up getting taken advantage of. He likes one-on-one trade agreements, the U.S. with one other country at a time. But you're saying this is not that with China. This is just the U.S. taking a unilateral action with China, which is going to spark retaliation. Do I hear you right?
But it's limited retaliation. So they're allowed. The U.S. is allowed to take action, for example, with safeguards. And the EU, I think, has already indicated that they're going to treat this as a safeguards action. In that case, it just means that since the U.S. takes away market access, then the EU or China can take away a similar level of market access. It's tit for tat.
Right.
But it's just you gave me something. Okay, take it away. But then I'm not going to give it to you. Another thing to keep in mind, though, about multilateral versus bilateral deals, the reason the whole system was set up at the end of World War II, and we have to go back to our grandfathers and great-grandfathers, right, was their sense was that they'd gone through a half century of conflict driven partly by colonial trading systems, big countries taking advantage of small ones. There was a bunch of things that, you know, they just didn't want to see again. And so there are parts of the multilateral system, like what's called MFN. You can't discriminate and give some countries a good deal and other ones a worse deal, that are meant to protect small countries from big ones ganging up on them.
Last question, and it's a really big picture question about this moment in history. There's an op-ed in the Times today, New York Times, by Ruchi Sharma from Morgan Stanley, which asks, is Trump starting a trade war? And it says the deepest fear is that steel and aluminum tariffs will echo the mistake of the infamous Smoot-Hawley tariffs of 1930, which provoked a global trade war and helped fuel the Great Depression. But he writes, the alarmists are getting a bit ahead of the story. Periods of deglobalization, when nations begin shuttering their borders to flows of trade, money, and people, tended to be slow processes over history, not sudden events. The last era of deglobalization actually began when countries turned inward after World War I, more than a decade before Smoot-Hawley and the Great Depression. It's important to view Mr. Trump's latest trade actions in that historical context. The suggested higher tariffs on steel and aluminum are too narrowly targeted to trigger a trade war. but represent another chapter in the evolving era of deglobalization. So writes Ruchir Sharma. So, Professor, how much do you agree with his take on history, whether it's necessarily a horror for there to be a period of deglobalization to correct some things after a period of massive globalization?
Yeah, so I think we're mixing globalization with the technical change that we've had. Again, back to this idea that we've broken up value chains, we've shut down integrated production, jobs have gone away because of that, communities have become distressed. It's not just global trade, right? So we had steel production and motor vehicles move from the north to the south in the U.S., textile production similarly. So it's not just global, it's also within the U.S.
And it's also closing the borders. And I don't want to get sidetracked by it, but in 1924, right in the period that Trump is writing about, the U.S. really closed the borders at that time, and they weren't really reopened until the 1960s.
This is true, and it's okay to get distracted, because I think all of this is a bit distracting. There's just so much going on. But I think it's useful just to – I would agree broadly with the comment. But I'd say look at the crisis that we came out of and compare that to Smoot-Hawley. Okay, so sliding into the Great Depression, we did have an episode of escalating protection. In the Great Recession, that didn't happen, right? There was a resounding – there was no sound. Nothing happened. Right. In a sense, the governments worked very hard to preclude that, and they worked together. And currently, it may be that the White House doesn't feel cooperative. But I think, broadly speaking, the major players who avoided us going into some protectionist spin during the Great Recession are still there. And I think there's an interest in keeping the system going, which is also why I don't think this particular step would lead to a global trade war per se. I think there will be tensions, but I think we've had those before. I think the system's engineered to sort of handle that pressure by containing it so that it's somewhat isolated. So, I wouldn't be so pessimistic. But I do think that this is that there's a real problem, but this doesn't fix it.
Joseph Francois, Managing Director and Economics Professor at the World Trade Institute at the University of Bern, capital of Switzerland, and he contributed to a report on the tariffs question released by the Trade Partnership. Thank you so much for coming on.
Okay, thank you.